pay much attention to bells even when they are ringing. Well, I hope someone shows up today. I don't want you guys to have to do all the translating. Yes. Yes, the same. Same as just the same situation as now. I want to check though, because sometimes they're almost new tile types. Let's see, what page are we on there?
Just page 292.
Okay. I need to give it back here. Yes. Yes, and that's what you have on page 290 at the bottom there. You'll see it too. It's a little bit different because it's not an Omicron Nu Tau, it's an Omicron Tau. So you've got Lelukos, Lelukuya, Lelukos, and then the genitive singular Lelukotos, Lelukuyas, and Lelukotos. So once you know that, then you know the rest of the paradigm. It's going to be like an Omicron Tau stem, third declension. So the only thing is you won't have the new. Now notice they give you the date of plural also, Lelukosi, Lelukosi, and so forth there. So it looks pretty much like the other ones in that respect. So those are the problems that you'll have is dative plural, wondering where the dative plural is and so forth. But from that you can fill out the rest of it. Maybe I should call everybody's attention to that. So. You need to know how to recognize the forms. In other words, I'm not going to require. I'll just be giving you a form, and in other words, you'll need to be able to recognize whether it's aorist or you know whatever and so forth. You know. In other words, you might do a quick review of Luo. If you know what Luo does, and if you know what the rules are as far as these compounds, then that's all you need. So since they're all of Luo, I try to make it as simple as possible. But and it'll be recognition rather than the other. Yes.
And there were a lot of words that began from the skeleton and connected.
Oh well, you do, but I'm not going to really be, the quiz isn't going to be covering those specifically. No, the reciprocal pronouns and so forth. Those are all pretty straightforward. In other words, there's nothing really dramatically new that you've had there, and I don't think it's going to present any problem. I just wanted to make this quiz, you know, try to hit the things that are going to be the biggest problem for you recognition-wise. So a little bit mercy there. So as you recall on the quiz, now Mark brought up a good point here. I think we maybe quickly mentioned it before, but we hadn't really spent any time with it. And that's with regard to the participle for the perfect. If you look at page 290, and then also page 292, you've got your paradigm, perfect active infinitive, perfect active participle. You notice that participle is lelukos, lelukuya, and lelukos there. The question might come up, what does the rest of the paradigm look like? And you might expect it, on the analogy of the other participles that you've dealt with, to have an omicron nu tau stem, like lelukontos or something, but it turns out not to be. It turns out to have an omicron tau type stem. And if you see on page 290, near the bottom, the participles, or the paradigm for the participles given there, on Roman numeral 1 there, under part E, participles, they give you the endings for the masculine, feminine, neuter, and then so you get lelukos, lelukuya, lelukos. The genitive singular, though, is lelukotos, lelukuyas, lelukotos. Not kontos, but kotos, which gives you what your stem is, somokron tau, added to the base. And then your dative plural is lelukosi, lelukuyas, lelukosi. It's omokron sigma. So it's not omokron upsilon sigma because it doesn't have the nu in there. It doesn't get assimilated. So looking at that will give you the full paradigm there. As far as the menos, you know, the passive type participles, there's no problem there. That's just like what you've seen before. Okay. So if you learn that genitive form, it'll really solve that. So just to remind you on the quiz, it'll be recognizing the forms of the perfect and pluperfect for Luo and the optative for Luo. So you need to go through those paradigms. Then there will be some sentences that you'll have to translate in English from Greek that will be of those various types of conditionals. And so you'll need to be able to do two things, translate the sentences, and I'm not looking for obscure vocabulary, although I'm going to be using some of the verbs that are on page 273, I think it was, or a list of those compound verbs, 279. And so that's just a matter of Luo with one of these prepositions, and it'll be relatively simple as far as, but do go through that list, know what each one of those means, and then how to form the aorist and that type of thing. In other words, you might review your paradigms for Luo. This isn't going to be forming paradigms, but it'll be recognizing them, so you should just at least review it to the point of recognition, and then be able to identify the type A, type B, and type C type conditional clauses. That won't be as difficult as it would be for me to give you the English and have you write the Greek. At least you'll be able to see it. And on page 273, you see the criterion for determining the difference. And it's going to be based on form. You don't have to worry so much about meaning and trying to decide whether the author believes it's actual or possible or whatever. That's kind of a result of looking at it. But as far as determining type A, type B, and type C, type A, you're going to have A with a verb in the indicative, in the condition, and then a verb in the indicative, imperative, or subjunctive, in one of its independent uses as the conclusion. Type B is going to be on with a subjunctive in the condition, with a negative of may, and same type of conclusion, so that A and B are distinguished in terms of the kinds of way in which the condition is set up. One is using the indicative, one is using the subjunctive. Then type C is determined by really both condition and conclusion. It's got A with the verb in the past tense of the indicative. That can be either aorist or imperfect, or even a perfect. And then the conclusion will be in a clause with the verb in the past tense, not necessarily the same one as in the first clause, but that will also be an indicative. So you'll have indicative in both the condition and the conclusion in the type C clause, and they'll both be in the past tense. So it's got more stringent conditions than the other ones do. Yes, Mark.
For type A, is there any possibility of confusion for type A and type C?
Yes, there could be. There could be between type A and type C. Suppose you had a type A that happened to have a past tense of the indicative in the condition, and it was not a negative. See, if there's a negative in the condition, then you usually be able to tell because one uses U and one uses may. But if it's not a negative, and suppose it's not a negative, and suppose they're both in the past tense, and they're both in the indicative, then there could be a confusion between type A and type C. I'll purposely not set that up for you. Yeah, you really kind of do. I think you might best think of it, at least for the test, think of it this way. If the conditions of type C are met, call it a type C, even though you might consider it a subcategory of type A. But the type C is getting the hypothetical conditions, and so usually your context will tell you it's type C anyway, because of the fact that hypothetical conditions are being suggested here. So I think that's the way we'll operate, is just to consider if type C's conditions are fulfilled, call it type C, not type A. I think that'll be a good rule of thumb for what we're doing. And then plus context. If you have context, the type C is expressing hypothetical conditions which the speaker believes are contrary to fact, and that'll be usually your final criterion for telling for sure that it's type C. Okay. Any other questions or observations? I should say this too. Should there be no class tomorrow because of snow or whatever, looks like the weather reports indicate we'd probably be all right. But if it should happen, assume that the test is automatically postponed to Thursday. And if there's no class Thursday, then the test is automatically postponed to next semester. And we'll just have to grade you on what you have so far. So that's our plan of attack there as far as that goes. So if there's no class tomorrow, you don't need to worry. Just come to Thursday prepared for the quiz. Okay, anybody else? Any question or observation about that? Okay, the first part of the quiz will be set up just like the last one was, where I'll give you the Greek forms and you parse them and vice versa. What's that? No, not really on these. The accents won't make any difference in determining form, so don't worry about them. It's basically just the standard rule of recessive accent, but I won't be grading you on those. Okay, anyone else? All right, let's continue our translating then. Time we have remaining. The Gospel of John. We left off in chapter 2. Chapter 1, yeah. Okay, I've got my mark on the wrong side of the page. Chapter 1, around verse 47, is that what you... We just finished 46, okay. So we're chapter 1, verse 47, and John, maybe we'll start with you over there. Let's go ahead and take verse 47. Okay, good.
Jesus saw. I'm
going to
start with and.
Yeah. Hebrew narrative, yeah.
It always starts with and.
Yeah, right.
Jesus saw Nathanael. Coming toward him and said about him.
Concerning him, yeah. It actually says present tense, but it's that thing where you're projected into the past. It says concerning him, about him, around him. Yeah. Okay.
Behold, a true Israelite.
Yeah, it's actually an adverb, alephos. So you might say, behold, truly an Israelite, something like that. Okay. Just so you know, it's kind of modifying the predication rather than modifying the Israelite per se. Okay. Otherwise, you'd have an adjective form. So behold, truly an Israelite.
That's the way they
translate. Or an Israelite indeed, something like that.
Okay.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be modifying truly?
Well, yes, it can follow. Usually it comes before it when you see it that way. It's still the same idea, though. Behold of a certainty, you know, see, that's kind of... I think normally if you want to say truly see, you probably put alephos out in front of ideh. But it's an adverbial, so you have to ask the question, how is it... What adverbial portion is it modifying? Is it modifying the command here, the imperative, or is it modifying kind of the idea, truly here he is one, or an Israelite in whom is no guile? It's kind of the problem is that the statement, an Israelite in whom there's no guile, I know, but... Did you? Okay.
I knew it was an adverb, but, you know, it seems kind of strange.
Yeah. Part of it is because, you see, you've got this ideh, and then you have just a kind of a, how would I say this, a nominative absolute almost. You've got just a nominative phrase, an Israelite in whom is no guile. You know, the in whom is no guile is a phrase modifying Israelite, and he's just saying, behold, an Israelite, basically, is your basic structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so the truly might be modifying the rest of that. Behold, Israelite in which there's truly no guile or something, or for a certainty there's no guile. Or it could be considered truly behold, but that's usually not used that way. So that's what you're set up with. But it's technically not really a sentence structure. Behold, an Israelite, you know, it's kind of an exclamation. And then in whom is no guile, that's a sentence structure, but it's a dependent clause referring back to Israelite. Okay, I've kind of finished it off for you there. But.
For Dolos, I was going to use Yaakov.
Oh, okay, right, for deceit, yeah, probably. Okay.
That's really interesting, though, because that I wonder how Yaakov would be.
Mm-hmm. It might be. It might be.
And, you know, of course, you see that distinction all the time between Israel and...
Yeah, for sure. And here's an Israelite that's not Jacob, man. Yeah, go ahead. Well, let's see. We'll check it here. Well, it didn't give it here. It's analogous. It should be an imperative form. Yeah. C. Yeah, it should be an imperative form. I don't think it's confused with any of the other ones. Mm-hmm. That's what it should be. Second person singular. Well, he's talking to whoever is with there at the time. Jesus, you know, it could be just to Nathaniel, too, unless there's somebody else there with him. Yeah, he's probably just talking to Nathaniel here, just revealing something about him. He's talking about him, but he's also...
So it's like he's talking directly to him,
mm-hmm.
and he's coming up to
yeah. him. And he says, behold, an Israelite. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Unless, now, we can't necessarily assume that Jesus isn't with some others here, but since it is a singular form, it's probably referring right to Nathaniel and giving him a revelation. Hmm? Yeah, Yedeth. Second person masculine, singular imperative. From Harao. Well, if you know, yeah, if you know about Hine in Hebrew, this seems to be the wherever you see Hine in the Hebrew, it comes out Yedeth in the New Testament. So there may be a consideration there as far as Hebrewism is concerned, without even with regard to the number of people around or anything else. And it may be just a conceptual thing, and he's not really necessarily specifically addressing a certain person, but he's just making a proclamation, as it were.
And mm-hmm. even then, if there were a crowd of people around.
Mm-hmm.
You might say it in the singular, indicating that
each individual, yeah, exactly. So we'll have to keep our eyes open for that when we find crowds of people and see if they're using Yedeth. Seems like the only thing I can remember in the New Testament is Yedeth. I mean, that's used lots and lots of times, but I haven't really paid attention to real carefully as to what the situation and the context was. So we'll just have to watch for that. Of course, those of you that are in Hebrew know that Hine is used constantly, and this is an equivalent. Hine doesn't have any conjugation, so there may be a connection there. Okay, yeah, that's kind of nice. Yeah, right. You need a break once in a while in Hebrew. Oh,
When I read it in Hinnah, I want to say, behold,
that. You got to watch for that, yeah. Okay. Verse 48, then. Dan, go ahead and continue here. Okay. Nathaniel says to him. Yeah, Nathaniel says to him. Yeah, whence or from where?
Okay, mm-hmm. From where do you know me?
Right.
Jesus answered and said to him, before the call to you,
yes, before Philip sounded to you, made a sound to you, yeah. It's an infinitive construction, so before the sounding of Philip to you or something, it's going to be a little awkward in English. So before Philip called you, you might translate it, even though it's not technically a
there. Can I stop on a couple words there?
Okay. Okay, sukane means fig tree.
Okay.
And onta is a participle of the verb to be. So, as you were being under the fig tree.
Okay. Before Philip called you being under the fig tree.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Before Philip called you being under the fig tree, and well, you know, the idea is a circumstantial participle. He called you while you were under the fig tree. So that's the idea. Well, before Philip called you, you being under the fig tree, I saw you. So that's the idea. Okay. Yes. Glenn.
It's on the third day. It looks like a aorist passive.
Yes, it is.
Jesus having been answered and said.
Okay, it's because it's a deponent verb. It's apokrinomai. It's the verb. Oh. So it's deponent, so it's got passive forms. Yeah.
So
yeah, he answered. No, yeah, he answered and said to him. Okay.
Apokrinomai.
Yeah, apokrinomai is the verb form. This is interesting, too, because remember when this was one of those idioms. There was another idiom like this, apokryphes, using the aorist participle, and then answered. And they argued there that this was simultaneous action or something along those lines. And here we see the same kind of an idiom, only this time it's using the not the participle, but the regular aorist form, the indicative form. And again, he's listing it in order, like he answered and said. And the answer is coming before the saying. And their argument before was, well, it must be simultaneous action, but here it's not even using a participle, and it's still using the same kind of construction. He answered first, then he said. And to me, that is, again, a strong indication that their concept of answering is formulating the answer in the mind and then saying it out. You know, thought first, you know, logos, in the old logos, then first the thought, then the expression. So I think that's kind of interesting. Just like to give another point in favor of the aorist participle being antecedent action. All right. Yeah, in your textbook they should give you some example there. I think they're if you look back at that aorist participle section.
Page 188.
Yeah, apokryphes o Petros apen auto. They're arguing that it's simultaneous action there, and that's because it's using an aorist participle. They're claiming the aorist participle is simultaneous action in that instance, and I'm saying that there's still a sense in which it's antecedent action. And here we see it without the aorist participle, just a normal aorist construction with indicative verbs, and we still see this sequence. Okay. Now, they might argue that this is simultaneous action, too, but I think it's certainly supports the idea that their concept, it's always in this order. You don't see him saying, he said and answered. It's always he answered and said. Okay. Okay, we get verse 49. Yes. Eric. Okay, good. Mm-hmm.
Rabbi or teacher, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel.
Okay, good. You are the Son of God, and you are the King of Israel. Okay. Of course, it doesn't have the article on King. So this is almost to remind you, for the Hebrew students, of the construct relationship, King of Israel, since Israel is a definite concept. You're getting a definite concept in the Hebrew idea of King of Israel anyway. And that may be carrying over somewhat idiomatically here too. You could translate this, you are a King of Israel. But it might be best just to translate it, you are King of Israel. That might be the best way in English to do it. Just don't put the article in and just say you are King of Israel. It's giving you a pretty good idea of the sense of it. It's emphasizing quality, not identity. Without the article, perhaps, but it's in English, instead of saying a king of Israel as if there are many, just say you are king of Israel. That'd be the best way to express this. Okay. Yes, Glenn.
I just wanted to compare this apokryphe here versus the one before the statement. All
they do is here say. Just apokryphe, yeah, without saying April.
Without having. I was wondering what the difference in the emphasis then would be. It's almost like apokryphe just carries the idea of responding to the
yeah.
other person and not really explaining or anything.
Right. Yeah, it's a shorter form, and it's It's just kind of keeping the narrative going. Once you've gone along in the narrative and you've established that a conversation is going on, and just apokryphe, just here's his answer, and then, and again, of course, you'll see it in the next verse, apokryphe Jesus kai apen. There he goes back to the apen phrase. And in some instances, it may be, now this one looks like it is a direct quote. It's just telling you exactly what he said, word for word. In some instances, apokryphe could just mean he answered and this was the gist of it. In other words, without giving a quotation. In this case, though, it doesn't seem to fit that way. It does seem to be in a direct quotation. Okay, verse 50. Glenn, you're up next.
Mm-hmm.
Get used to that after a while.
Right.
Okay, that may be it too. Okay.
And Jesus answered and said to him,
because I think because will fit better here. And then the next one will be that.
I said to you. Okay, because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, you are believing?
Right, yeah, make it a question. They put a question mark there for you, so, yeah.
You are believing?
Right, you are believing? Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm there for.
This is a little bit idiomatic, but you'll see this phrase quite frequently.
These things are greater.
Okay, it's a comparative construction here. Greater things than these, you might say, or greater than these things, greater of these things. Literally, you will see. Mm-hmm. Greater of these things you will see, or in other words, greater things than these you will see. Remember, your ways of expressing comparative are either with a genitive or with a particle A in the same case that you had before. So this one's using the genitive. So greater of these things, literally, you will see. Or we would say greater things than these you will see. Okay, good. So Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you that I saw you, there's the two uses of hoti, that I saw you down under the fig tree, hupo kato. It's kind of a picture of hupo is under and kato. It's from kata down, so down under, you might say, down under the fig tree. Are you believing? Okay, good Australian term there.
It's kind of strange for a period.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that omega? Is it?
I think it's being considered technically an adverb, but it's certainly got a prepositional idea here too. This might be a compound preposition built from these two. You probably see grammar books analyze it two different ways. It might be interesting to look it up in the analytical, see what they call it. If they call it a preposition or if they call it an adverb. Yes? Okay, it may just depend on how the book decides to go with it. This omega is often seen as an adverbial ending, so they're probably, you know, a lot of them are going to call this an adverb. But its function is just like a preposition. You know, you've got genitive case used with it and so forth. So, in a certain sense, prepositions may be called just a subcategory of the general category of adverbs, even though you can see prepositional phrases modifying nouns. You can see adverbs modifying nouns sometimes too, so that can be. There's connections there. I mean, it's not a real clear-cut line between a preposition and some of these adverbs. Okay. Yes, opse is from hara'o, and it's the second person singular future middle indicative. So it's a future middle form. And so the idea is you will see for your own benefit, as it were. In other words, got that middle idea to it. Because with the future, you do have separate forms for middle and passive. Okay. Verse 51, Mark.
Hi, Lady Alto, Amin, Amin, Lego, Humin, Opsis, Ton, Uranom, Aneo, Gota, Kai, Tu, Angelus, Tu, Da'u, Anabinontas, Katabinontas, Epiton, Rion, Tu, Antoku.
Okay.
And he says to him, truly, truly, I say to you, plural, you, plural, will see the heaven opening, or
it's a perfect participle here, so you will see the heaven having been opened, something like that.
Been opened with a present result.
Right, exactly.
And the angels of God.
Okay, did you have a question there, Eric?
Is it plural?
Which one now? The perfect participle is a singular masculine. It's a perfect active participle, accusative singular masculine. So it's accusative there. That's where the off is coming from. So there can be a confusion between those. And this is from anoigo. I think we had that verb before, to open, anoigo.
Having been
opened? Right, having been opened with the present result. In other words, it was opened and it's still open. The idea is that it was opened at a point and it's still open. Okay, so, and yet this whole thing is projected in the future. You will, in the future, see. It's interesting, he shifts to the plural here, as Mark noted. So he seems to be talking not only to Nathaniel, but if there were other disciples there with him, he's talking to all of them, or if it's just talking to Nathaniel and he's the only other one there, he could be talking in general to the nation of Israel or to all the believers or whatever, you see. Even though he's talking to one individual, you people will see. And this can happen. You can talk to someone, and if somebody's representing a whole group, then you can talk about the whole group there too. Okay. This distinction between singular and plural is one that we don't have in English. The old English, you know, had a difference between the ye and thee, you know. And that's why King James sometimes is better in some respects. It's got that distinction, although I'm not sure if they always follow it clearly according to the Greek text. But there are passages in which it's good to know whether he's talking about it singular or plural. Some passages dealing with the church and so forth, some of the Pauline epistles especially, it makes a difference whether he's talking to the group or just one individual. Yes?
Well, this verse is prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if there was ever a case where he talks prophetically in the singular, or whether it's always in the plural.
It may be an indicator that he's generalizing, you know, and that he's talking in the future. And I would guess that you're more likely going to see future prophecies like this when they're directed to an individual and speaking of a nation, that you'll see him in the plural. I wouldn't say that dogmatically, though, because there may be a prophecy that deals with a single individual. For example, a prophecy of Peter and how he was going to die or something. There would be something singular. But if it's a prophecy that is applicable to the whole body, you're likely to see that in the plural. We'll have to watch that. I don't think it would be necessarily required, because in some cases, like John mentioned before, he might be individualizing and saying that each one of you is going to experience this. And sometimes it may even say that. It may say each one. And okay. Chapter 2, then, verse 1, and Dale, you're up next.
Okay.
Gamos means wedding. It was a wedding.
What?
Okay. Any of the other ones there that?
I'm not quite sure the syntax here, but.
Okay.
And to the day the third.
Mm-hmm. We might say on the third day. With reference to the third day.
Baking can be as well.
Consider Gamos the subject of a genito. A wedding came to be, something like that. A wedding came to be, or we might say a wedding happened.
Okay.
Okay.
Or occurred or something like that.
Literally, it would be a wedding came to be.
Yes, right. Or a wedding became.
in the kind of Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother of Jesus was there.
Yes, and the mother of Jesus was there. Okay, it came means there. Yes. Yes, I think so. I probably would analyze it locative as within the sphere of the third day this happened. In other words, in that position. But remember, dative was used in sometimes genitive and sometimes accusative also. This falls into those special categories of these various cases that we covered in one of those last chapters. And it's dealing with a time reference. But I think the picture here using the dative is in that location, within the confines of the boundaries of the third day this happened. And so what you're looking at is an event that is taking place within the confines of that third day. Yes?
It brings up a point, a question I have, that you've mentioned, in bits and pieces, the data block and instrumental idea, but you've never really elaborated on how to differentiate between
right.
what the difference is and how you tell in context what it is.
Yes.
Whether you would ever be getting to that.
Yes. Definitely. That's one of the high priorities for this next section we're going to get into in Dane and Manti, is looking at the uses of the cases. In fact, we'll be going through locative, instrumental, dative, and so forth, the ablative versus the genitive with the genitive case form, and then within the genitives, looking at many different kinds of functions of the genitive. So I've been alluding to some of these things, but we're going to be treating that in detail here real soon. So that's one of the things that you can look. Yeah, right. Now, I can just say this for right now. The determination as to whether something's locative, instrumental, or just a dative idea is one that's based on context exclusively, because the forms are no different. In other words, the so-called instrumental form or locative form is no different than the dative form. There's only one form involved. And so some books go so far as to make the instrumental or the locative separate cases entirely, and even though the forms are the same. And this is where the big raging debate is, whether it's 8-case system or 5-case or 4. And so without getting into the, committing ourselves one way or another on which way we're going to analyze this, we will explore the use of the dative and look at examples in the New Testament and see the kind of use that it has. This instrumental idea, part of the problem is this. Part of the problem is just the same problem we have with prepositions. What's happening is that the Greeks got one form, and English translates it several different ways. And so we break up this form into bits of different subcategories depending upon how we would translate it into our idiom. And that doesn't necessarily, however, mean that the Greek has got some fundamental difference. The Greek may just have, it's just got this form. And that plus context is giving them a concept. And so that when we look at the different contexts, we come up with a different idiom for it. So that's the way I think is the real answer to the question. It really is one form in Greek, and they're probably not making a whole lot of distinctions in their own minds except by the context. And I think this locative idea is perhaps the more I've seen it, and if any of you choose to take some of these prepositions, you may see this too, or even some of the case functions. I think the locative idea is perhaps more germane to the whole idea of data than anything I've seen. In other words, I can see almost all of them as a locative idea, the idea of limiting the location of something within a certain sphere. But we'll get into that later on. That's a lot of fun. Those are some of the fine-tuning that we'll get into. Okay, see, it's that prepositions and the case functions and the article, some of these things where we've kind of given some fuzzy guidelines, but we haven't given a lot of detail that we'll be spending some time with here this next semester especially. Okay, any other questions on verse 2? Okay, verse 1, excuse me, chapter 2, verse 1. Okay, verse 2 then, Price.
Okay. And I would say, and also Jesus, disciples, came into the wedding, I guess.
Okay. Ekklesei is from kaleo, and it's an aorist passive form. And so it's referring to Jesus here, and then and his disciples is kind of tacked onto it. So you might say Jesus was called. third person singular. Jesus was called, so you might say, and also Jesus was called and his disciples into the marriage. And here's another instance. I think we saw another one of those where the singular verb form was used, and it's really referring to Jesus, and then it says, and his disciples. And if another verb was stuck in there, you might see the plural form and, ekklesion or something to count for his disciples. But you might say, Jesus, but also Jesus was called and his disciples, or and also Jesus was called and his disciples into the marriage. And the idea of into, of course, is, you know, coming into the place where the ceremony and so forth was taking place, and into that fellowship and so forth. Yes?
Really, the compound sentence with no verb on the second
part. Right. Right. The verb's understood in the second part. And that's why they can get by with it. But you see, the focus is upon Jesus. You know, you can kind of sense this. You know, instead of just saying Jesus and his disciples were called, the focus is Jesus was called and his disciples, you know. They're kind of in a secondary, of secondary importance. The important one was Jesus. Okay, verse 3, Stephen.
Kai Kere Santos, when you legate the material to Jesu proton, when you look
exclusive. Okay. Okay, it's from hystereo, and it means to become lacking, to become lacking. So the idea here is this is the first aorist active participle, and it's genitive. By the way, can anybody identify this construction? This is a genitive participle, and then oinu is your... Anybody recognize it? Yeah, genitive absolute. Genitive absolute. So oinu is wine, and so this is an aorist participle, meaning to become lacking. So might say wine having become lacking.
And wine having become lacking, mm-hmm. The mother of Jesus says toward him that there is no wine or the wine.
Right. Echusin is to have, so, and it's third person plural, so they are not having wine. Yeah, they have no wine. They're not having wine. Okay. Any other questions there? So good old genitive absolute. Construction here. Nice to see those once in a while. You can see, though, if you didn't recognize the existence of genitive absolute construction, you might be doing a lot of double takes on this one. Okay, verse 4, John. Okay. This is going to be a bit idiomatic.
And Jesus is saying to her, what is of me and you, or what is to me and you?
Yes, that's literally what it is. What is to me and to you?
I guess you would say, what is it that is to me and that is to you also?
Right. In other words, what do we have in common? That's kind of the idea. What is to you and to me? And what do I have to do with you, as it were?
Or maybe it would be better if we said, what is to me also to you?
Mm-hmm.
Given that it's, or that is also to you.
Mm-hmm.
Woman.
Woman. It's quite a way to address your mom. Not yet. Mm-hmm.
Not yet the hour. The hour of me having been.
Okay, it's a little tricky here. This AK does look like an aorist or something, but it's actually a present form from ACO. The verb is ACO with an ADA, so it's tricky. ACO, excuse me. Yeah, it's rough reading.
This is a perfect of.
Yeah, this is from Heiko. Yeah, I see what you're, you know, it almost looks like that there isn't any perfect form for to be, though, so. I could see how you can go to that conclusion, you know, you got the Ada-type sound and the kappa for the perfect, you know, and so forth, but the present only has an imperfect form for the past, and that's it. Yeah, there's just a plain old present form from Heiko, third-person present, singular. Third person singular present active indicative. To arrive. To arrive. Not yet is arriving the hour of me. My hour is not yet arriving.
Heiko?
Mm-hmm. Heiko. The Eta, Kappa, Omega with the rough reading. Heiko. So this is just your third person form. Just take the Omega off, put Epsilon Yoda down there. Third person singular.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So not yet the hour of me is arriving.
Yeah, is arriving. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say it that way exactly, because that
doesn't
sound like
a participle,
but there's really no other way to say it.
No, there really isn't, because it's because of the meaning of the verb. Okay, that's quite a... This verse, I'm sure, is in part given for the benefit of future Catholics.
Yes.
But
what I'm thinking about is, you know, when you're reading that, though, it's like the hour is arriving, not yet. That's... It seems like that's just a real good example of present progressive. Like, because I kind of not yet ever in the present, not yet in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, well, not yet. It is a future idea in a certain sense because we recognize that it hasn't happened to this point. But you could consider it a negation of the present consummation of the idea. In other words, the idea has not is not consummated at this point. Not yet is arriving. In other words... right, but it hasn't happened yet. So you've got the progressive idea. In other words, you're viewing something that's got a progressive tenor to it, but the progress has not been completed at this point, which automatically throws you into a future state of expectation. So all you're really saying is it hasn't arrived yet, and that's throwing you into the future, but it's not really a future statement. The statement itself is a present statement. It hasn't yet arrived. Okay, but you certainly got that progressive idea. You know, you're being carried along in the sense of expectation, waiting for the arrival of the thing. Okay, and it might be considered, since it's a present form, there might be a question here. Since a present can either be indefinite aspect or progressive aspect. It depends on how you think of arriving and whether you think of the hour as a specific point in time or as a general period of time in which a lot of events will happen. So that's the way that the decision you have to make as far as translating it. Greek doesn't really nail it down either way. Okay, verse 5 then, and who's up next? Jim.
Okay,
yeah. Hey, okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. We get word deacons from that. Yeah, servant to the servants.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Might say.
Right. What he might be saying. Yeah, it's a subjunctive form.
You do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. What he might be saying to you, do. Good. In other words, whatever he tells you, do. Whatever he says to you, do. There's that particle on there, hoti on, whatever he might. You know, it's giving you that kind of a, what we call it, an indefinite sense. So whatever he might be saying to you, do. And then the second poiesis ata is just an imperative. Second person plural. Okay. Which one? It's an aorist imperative. It's not indicative, but it's an aorist imperative. So
that takes the
that's
what it is. Okay.
Yeah,
so the augment's going different.
Right.
The aorist.
No augment on it.
Okay.
Does
it need
to
end
in one through? Mm-hmm. That's a contract verb too, so.
Yeah.
Okay, and this lege is a present subjunctive, so it's emphasizing progressive aspect, whatever he might be saying to you, rather than if you use an aorist subjunctive here, but whatever he says to